We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. Pape has everything you need when it comes to John Deere. Go up and see them. They got mowers, tractors, implements, you name it. Got some good financing going right now, too. If you're looking for some 0%, they've got it. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. Oh, don't forget their phone number, 530-226-9226. And Erin was kind of tangled up in her wires there. She, her head was glued to the table because her cord was 6 inches long.
Let me tell you, it's another episode of We the People Radio.
Yeah, it was an episode there.
I mean, that.
Stalling for time.
There is always an episode involved. It all seemed fine until I put the headphones on, and then my head had to be laying on the desk. Yeah, not the most convenient. So at the risk of maybe... Let's see, what will we call it? Overplaying our hand?
Is there such a thing?
No, there isn't. Besides that...
We can do whatever we want.
Yeah. I know, because we are the people.
Oh, but look at Kathy. I guess you're going to be a regular. So we have Kathy and Officer Joe with us today because we are doing a... Let's see, we kicked this interview from March, I believe.
Yeah.
It was kind of a long time ago. This was Dr. Ken Finn that was going to be with us in March, but he got sick. And, well, he wrote himself a doctor's note, and then he got out of doing the show with us. So, of course, that makes perfect sense. We never saw the note, but we assumed there was one. Officer Joe was in charge of that. We'll blame him.
I'm thinking he probably didn't smoke any pot to feel better, huh?
No, I'm pretty sure he didn't.
Probably didn't do that.
Probably didn't happen. So we titled today Marijuana Medicine or Myth, because Dr. Ken Finn is the founder of the International Academy on Science and the Impact of Cannabis, ISAC. And we have that on our site at wethepeopleradio.us. And if you go to the tab marked pot, we put all the shows under that topic, unless I screwed up and missed one. But, you know, I try to put them under there so you don't have to scroll endlessly through the archives. But there's a wealth of information. We spoke about the legal side. There have been some interesting developments in that. We had Dave Evans with us last week. We talked about the legal side. We've had the research folks. We've had just a really wide array. We've had the sheriff on.
The moms that have been very active.
Moms. You've looked at the impact on families. So we've kind of done all these things, and we've had some medical people on. But just a little snippet on our guest, Dr. Ken Finn. He graduated medical school from the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston in 1990. He completed residency in physical medicine and rehabilitation from the University of Utah in 1994, board certified in physical medicine and rehabilitation, as well as pain medicine. And therein lies the most interesting part, is the pain medicine part, and pain management in 2000. Practicing medicine in Colorado Springs since 1994, Finn serves on the board of the American Board of Pain Medicine Exam Council. So... this whole thing about, you know, this being this medication, and especially as regards pain, we thought it was really, really important to kind of bring that to the public, because we're being told a lot of things that are not necessarily true. And just for having more struggles down here? We're having some technical struggles that are causing a little distraction here. But the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis is a huge organization, a great place to get information and do research. So,
Aaron, you go to their library and you can find out every single thing you want to find out about cannabis. And they are the gold standard in the United States. When I refer boards of supervisors or politicians, I always refer them to ISAC's site.
And just kind of cutting to the end of his bio that's posted on the website for today, which is May 7th, 2023, Dr. Finn is a voluntary clinical instructor for the University of Colorado Medical School in the Colorado Springs branch, and he's done that from 2017 to 2020, sees pain patients at the Colorado Springs Rehabilitation in Colorado. So this isn't, you know, somebody who wrote a book about it. It isn't somebody who's just guessing and shotgunning it. This is somebody who works in that industry, deals with actual people who have been impacted by this. How about that? I was going to say harmed, but that sort of buries the lead, I guess, a little bit. Dr. Finn, we're glad you're not sick today, or any other day for that matter.
I'll be back. Putting up with my illness.
Oh, we had a little fun with the doctor's note thing. We couldn't help it.
No worries.
All right, so nothing. I know Officer Joe has like a list. Look at him; he's got a list.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead. We defer to your list.
Well, thank
Where would you.
You
like to begin?
Thank you. First of all, in full disclosure, I do know Ken. He and I have presented to cannabis boards before. And I hold him in very high regard. So, Ken, welcome.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Who, what, why is Isaac? First of all, what doctors are on your board, and was it started by doctors for doctors to get information on cannabis? Could you tell us a little bit
more
about
Isaac? Yeah, I mean, it was actually, I've been doing this for so many years, and kind of the reason I went down this road was because as a pain doctor and here in Colorado, we voted to legalize it for medicinal purposes in 2000. I mean, so we're 23 years down the road. We implemented it in 2001, and it was kind of dormant for a while because there really was no infrastructure with dispensaries or where patients needed to go or how were they going to get recommendations, et cetera. But as, you know, after a little politicking in 2009, we basically had de facto legalization when, you know, dispensaries opened up across the state like daisies, and actually to the point where they outnumbered McDonald's and Starbucks combined.
Wow.
I mean, there's so many medical marijuana dispensaries in the state. But then at that point, I started having patients coming to me as a pain physician that were on a very high amount of opioids, which we can talk about, which is a problem, and they were reporting very high levels of pain, you know, 10 being the worst pain. They were 8, 9, 10 out of 10, and then they were using marijuana for their pain. I'm like, well, clinically, that makes no sense. Why are you using any of it? You can have 8, 9, or 10 out of 10 pain off your opioids and off your marijuana. So I started doing a lot of research and reading and educating myself on the science of cannabinoids, and despite the fact that they're maybe components of the plant that can be analgesics or pain relievers, it isn't translating into the realm of product in the dispensaries. So I then, you know, started talking to my colleagues and doing presentations in local hospitals and working in schools. And the next thing you know, I've been for years, I felt like an army of one. I'm like, why are the doctors not saying anything about this? Because, you know, we already have legal addiction for profit industries with alcohol and tobacco and opioids, and now we simply added another layer of addiction for profit on it for reported use for pain, and the doctors weren't saying anything. So over time, I began to connect and network with some folks across the country, and we had this idea of, you know, let's put the information out there, because we, all of us individually, had the same story. We were all in our own little world, silos, talking about, you know, the harms that we're seeing. I mean, we have psychiatrists and emergency medicine doctors and pain physicians. And so that was the impetus to found our nonprofit, Isaac, which is the International Academy on the Science and Impacts of Cannabis. And we have a dermatopathologist, a psychiatrist, emergency medicine, and an internal and addiction medicine people on our board. But we also have physicians from all over the world that include people from Australia, from Ireland, from the UK. I mean, we have Sir Robin Murray and Dr. Marta DeForti, who are the most quoted researchers on the link between cannabis use and psychosis. We have people from Columbia University, you know, very well-rounded, and we're always wanting more people to come and join our ranks, because we're not prohibitionists, and this is not a prohibition issue. It's really we approach it from a scientific perspective, that despite whatever evidence may be out there for benefit, it's certainly outstripped and outweighed by the harms. And actually, if you've gone to our library, we've purposely limited the amount of information in our library because it's just so overwhelming. There's so much information out there, and it changes literally every day. I'm reading a paper or two or even three a day on things that are happening. Like the last 2 weeks alone, there was a significant amount of data that came out on schizophrenia. And I think this large study that came out of Denmark, and it's, you know, quoted also by NIDA, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, clearly stated that 30% of schizophrenic men could have been prevented if they had averted cannabis use disorder.
30%?
Wow. The daily frequency, you know, the near daily frequent high users. And then the products aren't what they were when I grew up. I mean, I grew up in the day of ditchweed where it was, you know, 2 to 4% THC.
Right.
And now, I mean, that doesn't exist in Colorado. The average smoked flower is about 20%. So you're talking about, you know, a 400% fold increase of what I grew up with. And that's just for the smoke stuff. And then you get into the concentrates that are 40 to 60% THC, and then the dabs, waxes, and shatters of the world, which are, they don't even look like plants. They just look, they look like gooey, you know, honey, thick stuff that you vaporize with a blowtorch. I mean, that's not medicine. I mean, combustion isn't a good delivery system for, as a medication. So that was kind of the impetus of founding Isaac.
I like that.
To provide mainly a resource for people that are interested. I mean, you can look at Google or PubMed and find what you may be looking for, but we were trying to find or develop a repository of cutting-edge information that allows anybody to look for information about, you know, psychosis or emergency room visits and, you know, pediatric poisonings and all these things that are happening across the country under the nose of more states legalizing. I just don't understand how and why people continue to go down this road knowing what is happening. And it's certainly frightening based on the stories I hear from my emergency medicine colleagues and what they're having to contend with in the emergency department.
Yeah, I can't, it's hard to fathom why people, you know, they go to a doctor if they have a medical issue, anything that's serious enough to go to a doctor for, I guess, but yet they'll go to their local bud tender for pain management. And frankly, I was a little surprised you didn't have any bud tenders on your board, but that's we can talk about that later. These are the guys that are these are the guys that are the experts that are advising people on what's the best product for their different conditions
Talk about malpractice.
Yeah, I'm surprised that somebody hasn't stepped up and filed some kind of malpractice against these people for.
You know, it's so funny you were talking about that because you know my experience, but most people don't know my personal experience. I was not currently a registered medical marijuana patient in the state of Colorado. Out of curiosity,
not a user, I might add, though, Ken.
Full disclosure, I don't use.
Right.
I was somewhat curious. Based on what my patients were telling me, you know, how easy was it to get my medical marijuana card? So a couple of years ago, I went online, and I didn't make anything up. I didn't lie. I was a very active person. I played collegiate soccer. I blew my knees out. I've had multiple surgeries. I need knee replacements, but I try to remain active, and it doesn't bother me that much. But, you know, every now and then, the cold front comes through. I take some ibuprofen or whatever. It works. But I went, it was a telehealth visit because it was kind of during COVID, and literally I was approved in a minute. And there was no, you know, 60 seconds. There was no medical record review. There was no questions on tried and failed treatments for my knees. They didn't ask for MRIs, reports. I could have been lying, so they didn't even ask me to see the scars on my knees because it was telehealth. And they actually never asked me my level of pain, which on a day-to-day basis runs about a 1 to 2 on a 10 scale. So, you know, mild pain, it's manageable, it's tolerable. Not at a point when I pulled the trigger on a knee replacement. And then a year later, I got my renewal in a similar amount of time. It was kind of bogus. So just this morning, I cast an email to some colleagues of mine asking, because when the medical marijuana rules sunset here in Colorado several years ago, under Colorado law, you have to have a bona fide doctor-patient relationship in order to recommend marijuana for your patients. And number two, you're required by law to maintain medical records. So I have asked for my medical records, and can't find them. I can't get them. I have asked my recommending physician, you know, about getting my medical records, and she said, just talk to your primary care doctor. So, I mean, to me, that does, as a physician, that does not constitute a bona fide doctor-patient relationship.
No.
And the fact that they don't have medical records clearly shows that doctors can practice bad medicine in plain sight of the law with no repercussions. And it took me 3 years of calling, and I can tell you, I talked to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, which oversees the medical marijuana program. I spoke to the Attorney General at the time. I can't remember who it was off the top of my head. And I talked to the Marijuana Enforcement Division, the State Medical Board, and everybody was pointing fingers at everybody else. And what I was finally able to get, somebody told me that when they passed the law, the state never designated an entity or an organization to enforce the law. So right now, it's a free-for-all. You can get your card. The doctor can tell you whatever. I asked my doctor, well, what if I had an adverse event like palpitations or chest pain or I felt a little psychotic or hallucinated? And she said, don't come to me. That's not my problem. That's not a bona fide doctor-patient relationship. So when, again, the Colorado marijuana law sunsetted, I said, well, please address this. And it was ignored. And everybody else at the state level ignored me. And actually, in the most recent bill that we had, Senate Bill 1317, where we're trying to discuss potency issues and access to youth, the same things came up again. Oh, you have to have this relationship and you have to have records. It's a bunch of BS because they don't do it. And I have documentation from my patients that, well, I got my marijuana card from this dispensary or this clinic over here, and I would call that clinic and ask for medical records, and they say we're not required to maintain them, which is a complete fallacy because by law they are. So it's just been this debacle, and nobody cares. It's just frightening to see the state, you know, this far down, 23 years down the road, despite the infrastructure that we have now, still ignores completely the issues surrounding these relationships with doctors and patients.
Why would it be any different if you wanted your, as far as the enforcement part goes, they wanted to go after a doctor for, say, prescribing a medication illegally or whatever, wouldn't that be the same folks that would enforce, or why would it be different?
Well, because the reason it's different is because it's not a prescription, and I think that's the side door.
Just
and I think the people that created the amendment, and that's the other problem, is that it's embedded in our Constitution. There's no way we're going to pry it out. It's embedded in its Constitution in Colorado. And the side door is, and the way they bypass it and loophole, is it's not a prescription. So they can't go after the doctor for telling a patient to do X, despite the fact that some doctors lost their license in other states during COVID because they were telling the patients things about COVID that may not have been true. because we didn't know at the time.
We don't know about any of that.
A little bit of a double standard there.
There was no lying
during that. It's a complete double standard. And the fact that the state just completely ignores their own laws is somewhat bothersome to me. And I think a lot of the other states have just followed suit. And if you're looking at, you know, you're talking about the opioid crisis that we're in an overdose crisis.
Hold that thought, Dr. Finn. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back. Our guest is Dr. Ken Finn. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana message. Don't buy the corporate marijuana lies whose end game is to not pay any taxes. California has failed to control the grows. Dispensaries are selling out the back door as well as selling other illicit substances. Do we really need the damage to the environment, suicide, schizophrenia, hyperemesis, cardiac events in elderly users, drug driving crashes, genetic damage, pulmonary damage, neonatal low birth weight, and lost IQ for our youth? No, we don't. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Songs about this, so little time.
Oh my God, that my youth, man.
Holy, like, you know, the songs we used to listen to, and then it's like, oh, it's got kind of an ugly tint on it. But Kathy was
Dr.
curious,
Finn.
Dr. Finn,
I have a question for you. When you got your recommendation, did the doctor say, oh, you should be taking 10 milligrams twice a day, or was there any type of dosage recommendation on top of that?
Absolutely not. And actually, when I got my renewal, I asked her more pointed questions about potency in particular.
Right.
We know that the high potent products are much more dangerous, particularly on the developing brain.
Correct.
And her response to me, I'm glad I was sitting down, said, well, you can use as strong of a product as you want as long as you feel okay.
Wow.
I'm like, so if I feel okay after drinking, you know, four beers, I feel okay.
Yeah.
I'll be clearly impaired.
Can't feel your hands, but...
Yeah. What's that?
Yeah, you can't feel your hands, but yeah. I feel great.
I feel fine when I take
I
five Norcos.
Fine. I keep bumping into the wall on my way out to my car, but I feel fine. But yeah, the fact that she didn't give me any dosing, and I asked her about dosage. Should I say 10 milligrams or 100 milligrams? And she clearly had no clue on dosing, product, potency, risk, adverse events,
wow,
or anything. She was simply, it was a cash cow for her.
Oh, yeah, and this is, I think this is what we're seeing across the nation is, mm-hmm, when we talk about the alcohol, you know, like obviously you would have immediately gotten a DUI for your alcohol consumption. And if you had been in a crash, you could actually sue the bartender who served you for over-serving. So now we have a situation where there is nothing as far as is the pot or the weed or the marijuana or whatever the heck you want to call it. There's nothing, no dosage, no ramification, no nothing. Who do you go back to for over-prescribing or over-recommending? Or there's nothing.
Because in Constitution, the CDPHE, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, protects and keeps confidential the identities of recommending physicians, despite the outcome.
Oh.
We have cases here in Colorado where youth have committed suicide,
right,
because of their cannabis psychosis, and the parents have nowhere to turn. They're screwed, and it's absolutely frightening that parents whose lives are being destroyed over this plant have nothing, they have no recourse.
Well,
not every kid that's going to use, obviously, to become psychotic or have a problem.
No, but 30% increase.
And that's with adult males.
Yeah, it's no small impact, especially when you look at what's, you know, lying all about our streets. Right?
Oh, I know.
We just have these people strewn about the sidewalks. And So if they weren't strewn about the sidewalks 20 years, 30 years ago, why is that happening now?
You know, that's a really good question. I wish I had a great answer, but I just think it's these open drug policies that
you can't ignore the point
of encouraging use, you know, decriminalizing, you know, 4 grams of heroin in Denver.
Well,
you can walk around with a lot of heroin on your person, right. and not get in trouble. But are you really going to be using 4 grams of heroin, or do you have intent to distribute?
Right.
We're battling the legalization of all drugs here in California, using the model of Oregon and Washington. And,
same here in Colorado.
And yeah. same thing. So I don't know why that's going on across the United States. What I found amazing, Ken, that you reported was the normal dosage that is subscribed to is 10 milligrams. And you see that's supposed to be listed on the products that are distributed.
With no here scientific foundation.
With right. no scientific right. foundation.
Right. Right.
But what I was...
It's an easy number.
Right, right.
It's an easy number. It's a metric number.
Right.
But if you look at the actual synthetic THC that's been around since 1986 called dronabinol,
right.
which is synthetic THC, the starting dose is 2.5 milligrams.
Right.
So one-fourth of what the THC that's in the stores.
What I was astounded to hear from you, and you can confirm this to me, was that you were seeing patients that were self-reporting something like 5,000 milligrams per day they were taking.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, that's...
They're in various delivery systems, smoking, eating, you know. And most of the time when I ask them, you know, what product are you using, the vast majority have no clue. They have no idea what they're using. Is it a Peyton Manning Kush smoked bud flower that they're smoking? And then I ask them what potency is. They have no idea.
No.
They don't know. It's all directed by the bud tenders who have the only requirement to be a bud tender is experience with marijuana, 21 years of age, and a pulse.
Experience meaning you smoked
you don't need
it yesterday?
Medical background or training.
Yeah. Or preferably before the interview.
Yeah. You smoked marijuana before the interview. So Ken, tell us. What is a paid pain management doctor, emergency room physician, and what do you see from that experience coming into the ER and into your clinic regarding high-potency marijuana?
I'm not an emergency questions. Medicine specialist. You know, as a pain medicine specialist, I had to go to medical school, which was 4 years, and I had to do a one-year internship and a three-year residency. And then I started practicing pain medicine after that before the day where they now require pain medicine fellowships. That's another year or two after your residency. So there's a lot of training involved and, you know, having done this for so many years and the people I'm working with, I write these test questions for people, physicians that want to take, you know, a higher level of understanding and care of their patients that have pain disorders, because it's a very challenging patient population, and it can be very frustrating, but it can also be very rewarding. In the emergency department, kind of a similar thing. They do a one-year internship and a three-year residency in emergency medicine, so it's several years of training. But what my colleagues here are seeing and what my colleagues across the country in the emergency medicine world, and the data in the scientific literature is showing a significant amount of, you know, child poisonings. Some of the, you know, the city of San Diego alone is now seeing 37 marijuana poisonings a day, and most of it is psychosis. If you just do the math, San Diego and San Francisco and L.A. and, you know, up and down the coast, there's hundreds of people with cannabis psychosis going to the ER. And then also in California, the number of people over the age of 65 has shot through the roof that are going to emergency rooms with marijuana poisoning. So they're getting inundated. And nobody talks about, you know, a lot of states that I've worked with around the country, they say, oh, we're going to make all this money, and right. it's going to save our budgetary woes. And, you know, I published a paper here that just between 2009 and 2014, just on the cusp of legalization, one mid-sized hospital in Colorado Springs lost $20 million just from marijuana-related ER visits.
Ken, what are the symptoms of marijuana poisoning?
It's a spectrum. People can get paranoid. They can have a suicidal ideation. They become psychotic. You know, they can be depressed, anxiety. They can also end up, you know, injuring themselves if they fall down the stairs or they get in a car crash. So there's a spectrum of potential marijuana-related presentations to the ER. But when I did my study and the data that's out there, it's very heavy in mental health. Like one of my authors, Sam Wang from Denver, was a pediatric emergency physician, and the number of teenagers and adolescents presenting the ER after de facto legalization went up significantly, with 70% of those presentations being psychiatric. And as you know, marijuana is the most prevalent substance now found in completed teen suicide. Never used to be that way. It's a kind of a bi-directional relationship. It's like, are they depressed because they're using, or are they using because they're depressed? We don't know. It's not a good study you want to do. But I've been following and tracking that data over time, but it never used to be that way. That trend shifted in 2012, where alcohol used to be the number one substance found when kids, adolescents, complete suicide. Now it's marijuana, and now it's nearly 30% that have toxicology is that they find marijuana. And half, the number two is still alcohol, but it's only 17%, nearly half.
Ken, so what about, you're talking about mentation. Tell me about some physical attributes like blood pressure, pulse, respiration, skin signs. What kind of presentations do you see when people are overdosing? And I'm going to use the word overdosing on marijuana.
Yeah, that would cause an emergency room visit. And
for a parent, Ken, who's...
I think the best terminology is poisoning.
Right.
Rather than
OD,
it's a marijuana poisoning, mm-hmm. And in the young kids, the younger the worse it is. They don't metabolize THC like an adult will, and 4% of the kids under the age of 5 or 6 end up on a ventilator. So depression.
Wow.
They can be unresponsive. They can actually seize. So the very young are really at risk of having much more life-threatening presentations than an adult. But then you get into the elderly population, and I'm knocking on the door of that one, but, by definition, at 65 and up, there's drug-drug interactions, because the older we get, we tend to be on more medications. And I'm just going to answer a real simple question. CBD, which a lot of my patients are gravitating for because of media and exposure, and they read about it. It's in ARP magazine, et cetera. Guess how many drug interactions CBD has? Anybody take a guess on that?
A lot, because I read your paper.
Oh, shoot. Well, then you can't answer the question.
Bill? It rolls to you, Bill.
But it's changed. That's the interesting thing. It's changed. It's not what it was when you probably read the paper. Joe, you want to have a stab at it?
Oh, put me on the spot here, Ken. I'm going to say probably hundreds of interactions at this point.
575 drug interactions.
Holy moly.
Yep. So, yeah. And actually, what I've been doing now, especially with my older patients that come to my office, and they say, hey, I heard about CBD. What do you think about it? I go, well, before I tell you, what medicine are you on? Well, I'm on an anti-inflammatory like ibuprofen. Well, let's go to drugs.com and put in cannabidiol. And under cannabidiol, they will have any medication. They will have a section on drug interaction. You can enter the medicine that you're on to see if it interacts with cannabidiol. And certainly, there you go, cannabidiol has a interaction with ibuprofen, which is very commonly made. And older people that have arthritis, they're very often taking ibuprofen or other anti-inflammatories for their aches and pains, and even without a physician supervision, are ingesting cannabidiol, and without any guidance or knowledge of potential drug interactions. There's another drug called warfarin, which is a blood thinner, and that interaction with CBD is potentially life-threatening. And I've had patients that have had life-threatening issues before they came to see me because of their cannabidiol ingestion with warfarin.
So we have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, I would really like to know, just from your experience as a physician, if people are using marijuana, like, A, can you tell? And B, would they
fess up?
Yeah, would they own up to that when you're trying to help them? We'll be right back. When I lost my mind, there was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions had an echo in so much space. And when you're out there without care, yeah.
just knew too much.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana message. Don't buy the corporate marijuana lies whose end game is to not pay any taxes. California has failed to control the grows. Dispensaries are selling out the back door as well as selling other illicit substances. Do we really need the damage to the environment, suicide, schizophrenia, hyperemesis, cardiac events in elderly users, drug driving crashes, genetic damage, pulmonary damage, neonatal low birth weight, and lost IQ for our youth? No, we don't. Remember, let's be careful out there.
They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing.
You ever loved someone so much you thought your little heart was gonna break in two?
Yeah, can't play that one enough. The crazy song. We might have to play that next hour, too. We've decided we like it. It's our favorite song now. All right. So you meet with a patient, and the patient says, I'm having whatever, whatever. Do they say, oh, and by the way, I have my marijuana card, or I'm using CBD, or... And what's the difference if they're, you know, I don't know, eating gummy bears or using CBD? Is there one?
Well, there's a lot of difference,
okay.
And I think over time I've begun to have much more open and honest discussions with my patients because they're curious. They want to know. I typically don't endorse the use of using both opioids and with benzodiazepines. I mean, we already have a black box warning for that. I also don't support using other centrally acting substances together, including cannabinoids and opioids. And a lot of times I'll give the patient the choice. I said, okay, well, if you're using marijuana for pain, let's taper your opioids off and have a nice life. And the vast majority are like, oh, no, 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 I don't want to do that.
Exactly.
I go, well, isn't marijuana like helping your pain? And most of my patients say no. I go, well, what's it doing for you? They say, well, it makes me sleepy or not care. And then I ask them about what they're using, what dosing. Smoking marijuana, you're going to have a much more rapid onset of effect, probably within, you know, 20, 30 minutes, where it peaks and then kind of gradually goes away. Edibles, on the contrary, they have a delayed onset effect, which is creating a lot of problems because people will eat a gummy bear or a cookie or whatever,
yeah,
and they're like, well, I don't feel anything, and then they eat another one or two pieces, and then they don't feel anything, and then it hits them like a ton
of
bricks, and then they have a problem. They become very paranoid. I mean, there's a case in Denver where, and it's public, it's Richard Kirk, who in 2014 had gone out to buy a bunch of edibles and became acutely psychotic because he'd had wasn't experiencing anything, so he ate a bunch of them, became acutely psychotic, and his wife panicked and was on 911 trying to get help, and during the 911 call, he got to the gun safe and shot and killed her.
Whoa.
He's
serving
30 years in prison for killing his wife. So now their three children don't have parents. So the delivery system will have a different onset of effect. And, you know, when I talk to the patients, say, well, what are you using again? They'll say, I have gummies. I actually had a patient who opened up her pack of candy in my office in the exam room and took a couple bites off of it. I'm like in the middle of the interview and the history and before the physical exam, she's like, oh, I go, yeah, tell me about your marijuana. She goes, oh, I got some right here. I'm going to have a piece right now. And she chomped a big piece of her gum.
Wow.
So, yeah. It's amazing. But they don't realize, I mean, I don't know if she drove herself, you know,
yeah.
And she's like, So that's the question. The problem I have is dosing. So, for example, the gummy that she had, it was a package, but I believe each gummy was up to 50 milligrams. So she took a nibble. What dose did she get? I have no idea. She has no idea.
Right.
you know, she took a little chomp off of it, and I'm like, well, was that like a 16 milligram dose you just scarfed down? I don't know. So that's the issue I have in terms of dosing, because there just are no standards at this point. And again, like I mentioned
and
earlier,
no warning labels.
What's
right.
that?
And no warning labels.
No warning labels, which is a huge problem. And the other issue is product integrity.
Right.
You know, what is
yeah.
she ingesting?
Right.
You know, we know that a lot of these products may be contaminated with anticoagulant rodenticides or pesticides or fungicides.
Spray adhesive.
Right.
That's what, I mean, we've seen 55-gallon drums of that out in the grows.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And that's the thing that, you know, these recalls that are happening, you know, you have to subscribe to them in Colorado to get a recall product. But they'll say, okay, well, today is May 7th. The warning comes out for fungus. So return your product that you purchased between November of 22 and February 22.
Yeah, sure.
So
it's gone.
Those products are long gone. And when you talk about, you know, fungus, for an example, there was at least one patient, I'm sure, where there's one, there was more. There's a cancer patient that was undergoing treatment in California, and he opted for his marijuana product rather than whatever they were offering him to manage his symptoms related to his treatment. And it was contaminated with fungus. So this cancer patient died from a huge fungal infection rather than his cancer.
God.
Because he had contaminated product. And California has an 18% fail rate when it comes to that sort of stuff. And the level of corruption, I mean, in Sacramento, they found the lab director purposely faking 30% of the pesticides he's supposed to test for. And that's rampant.
And yet, this person dies of a fungal infection, but the person or company that sold the product is not liable.
Yeah.
I don't know of any other product out there that you can retail and not have some kind of product liability.
Well, there is none. Pfizer shot.
Yeah, there's none. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's
there's
unbelievable.
None.
Pfizer shot.
So, Ken, getting back to physical attributes for parents, pulse rate, intoxicated patient, pulse rate elevated or depressed?
All the above.
Okay.
Potentially, and not all the above.
Okay.
Some patients or some people or adolescents, for example, may be using and be fine. You know, and somebody asked me to profile the at-risk person. And what I've kind of, based on what I know and read, it's usually a young male with a history of mental illness, depression, or what have you, that's using daily or near daily. That's the person that is much more at risk than the young woman or girl that goes to a party once a month and takes a hit off a joint one time. She's certainly not going to be at risk of developing a problem, whereas the other person is going to be at risk of developing a problem.
And isn't it interesting that in the spate of recent active shooters we've had done by young males, that many of those have been marijuana users with marijuana
history?
Yeah,
that's one thing that I've been trying to get a lot of work on. And it's so interesting how mainstream media completely dismisses that link.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, nothing to see there.
What's that?
Yeah, nothing to see there. Move along.
Yeah, it's like the penguins from whatever that little cartoon was. Like, nothing to see here, boys. Let's just move on.
I love them.
And, you know, I have examples of, like, the Richard Kirks of the world, who the onesie-twosies, where they might kill one or two people. When you get into the federal definition is three or more fatalities. And when you get into these mass shootings, I always am suspect, and I try to track down the toxicology report. And I have a growing library of people that have caused or did a mass shooting in various states, and only one thing in their system was THC. And I think it's just going to continue to happen time and time again. Like, I just did an FOIA request on the one from Allen, Texas, who shot eight people yesterday. And there was another article I read this morning out of Texas about kids getting into these, the isomers, the Delta 8s that are flooding
right.
the schools in
right.
Texas because of this, our lovely farm bill
right.
that has created all these loopholes on isomers and acetylated products that are ending up in schools across the country that haven't banned them.
Right. Same here in California. We banned the flavored tobacco products, but now the vape shops are big into the Delta 8, Delta 10, Kratom. Yeah, they're hot and heavy.
Yeah, it's interesting because people don't realize that when the Farm Bill passed, they make massive amounts of CBD from that.
Right.
And from the CBD, they create the Delta 8, the Delta 10, mm-hmm. the HHCs, the THCPs, because they all have the same molecular formula.
Right.
And then when they take Delta 8, they can actually change that molecule by acetylating it. I don't know if you've heard of the THCOs,
yep.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can acetylate the molecule, which is more potent. And most people don't realize that the U.S. government weaponized THCO in the 40s as a chemical warfare agent. And I have the paper. I read that paper. It was, like, fascinating because it eroded the muscle coordination of dogs 3 times faster than conventional Delta 9.
So they were hoping to give it to what, to distribute it against the enemy and have
the
them
enemy. Yep.
fall apart? Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, and in fact, some of these, the Delta 8s and those, what I did in my research is there's not even an age limit sometimes.
No, there was a 4-year-old in Virginia that died from
yeah.
Delta 8 and his mom's
yeah.
on trial
yeah.
for murder.
Because there's no, any kid could walk into a vape shop and buy these products because there's no age restriction.
Yep, they go to gas stations or what
yep.
have you. And the other question is, well, did the kid really get Delta 8 or was there something else
right.
in there too?
Exactly.
Because the whole product integrity platform that I have,
yep.
What is really in there? And there's been a lot of papers that have come out over the past few years saying, buyer beware, basically.
Right.
What you're getting and ingesting or inhaling may not be exactly what's on the label. I have an example of a hemp product from Colorado that was a Charlotte's Web oil. It's a small amount, like 30 cc's.
And that's given for seizures, correct? That was touted as being a seizure medication very early on, wasn't it?
It was touted as seizure medication, but now it's touted as a wellness product. So
rebranded.
There's nothing on the label. It doesn't say how much CBD or THC is in there because it's supposed to be 0.3% THC or less, blah, blah, blah. But it's the equivalent of a capful of NyQuil. And I have the certificate of analysis of that capful of NyQuil has 84 milligrams of THC in it.
Whoa!
That's a lot of THC because you're only supposed to like have a drop or two. But a lot of people, I would think, you know, the younger person that has the financial wherewithal to get this is going to shoot it before he leaves the parking lot and then become impaired because he has 84 milligrams of THC on board. I'm sure it's happened.
Well, it's like the idea that somebody's going to take a bite of a cookie or half a bite
right.
or...
Oh, I can eat an entire sleeve of Girl Scout Thin Mints.
Well,
sure.
Exactly. Besides that, I mean, even if you were going to say bite, are we talking the one where, you know, your brother says, okay, you can have a bite of my cookie? Well, that's, you know, 90% of it right there.
Well, what potato chip was it? I bet you can't eat just one.
Yeah.
Doritos.
Like
yeah. Yeah. Eat all you want. We'll make more.
Ken, are you finding
taglines for that?
Are you finding pushback? Two questions. Are you finding pushback from the medical examiners and coroners, and that when you try to get the information? And then, secondly, are you finding that the departments of health across the United States really just are not educated, and therefore they're not putting out the proper messaging?
And no pressure. We have like 1 minute, so you could pick one of those, and we could roll the other one on to the next hour if you'd like.
Oh, yeah, I think we can definitely dovetail. I don't have too long of an answer for that.
Fire.
But I'm not getting as much pushback from coroners and medical examiners. I mean, the departments of health, when I request a toxicology, it's a process. I mean, it can take me weeks. I'm still waiting for the Uvalde shooter's toxicology because that's a very interesting... It's probably the most interesting case, and I'd like to talk about this when we come back. It's the most interesting case I have on a mass shooter who's dead that is still an ongoing investigation. I'm still curious about that.
And we're still
waiting.
You might
be able to help me answer that, Joe.
Huh. Well, we'll talk with you some more about that. Our guest is Dr. Ken Finn, and you are listening to We the People. You can find us at
wethepeopleradio.us.
And I ain't leaving till they throw me down. Gonna have a little fun, gonna get me some. I'm here. I, you know I'm here for the party.
because I got high, because I got high.
Go to the next, go to the next, go to the next.
I was gonna go to work, but then I got high. Ooh, I just got a new promotion, but I got high. La da da, now I'm selling dope, and I know why.
Why?
Because I got high, because I got high, because I got high. La da 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 da, I was gonna go to court before I got high. I was gonna pay my child support, but then I got high.
Oh, I just want you all to know that I was forced to do that by officer.
That's my ghetto police.
They gave me 30 seconds notice to get that la da da.
Yeah, Liam pulled that one right out of the air.
What if we played Afro Man? Yeah, he should. Yeah,
we're gonna happen. Should have told me that 5 minutes ago. Nothing like waiting. Ah, well, sure, we could start off just with regular stuff, but that's not very fun. So, welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff.
Want to segue that into some sort of tractor talk?
You know, why don't I? I can do that. Our sponsor this hour is Pape.
Because you don't go buy a tractor if you get high, right? That's another downside. Huh. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Are you all done?
Maybe
Bill is not going to sell somebody a tractor under the influence of marijuana. He's an expert at it, and no one's sitting on that tractor.
Yeah.
All right, Bill. Tell us about that.
Okay. So our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, a drug-free workplace. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer, and they stock and sell pretty much anything John Deere. Go up and see them. They have a great inventory right now. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, or you can give them a call at 226-9226. Or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. They got some great financing right now, 0%.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to pay them to take the tractor.
Yeah, they haven't gone that low yet, but yeah, it's still available. Go up and talk to them, and they'll make you a great deal.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Bill loves it when we help segue him into his sponsorship.
Oh, I do. I look forward to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Not.
Oh, that's when the beauty of radio takes over, because they can't see us all falling out of our chairs laughing. Old Bill's trying to keep a straight face. So our guest, the first hour, and our hostage, the second hour, is Dr. Ken Finn. And before we took a break, we were getting into that whole messy area of cause and effect. How about that?
Yeah. Well, he had mentioned the mass shootings. I'm curious, has anybody actually done a study on these shootings? How many of the shooters are marijuana users?
Well, he said he was waiting on Uvalde. How long do you think that'll take, Dr. Finn, or do you think we'll ever find out?
So I think we will find out at one point, but, historically when I've gone down this road of trying to figure out what their substance use was from a mass shooter, it can take weeks to months, and I found that if the shooter is alive, just forget it, because it's going to be an ongoing investigation. They go on trial. They're incompetent, not incompetent, like the Boulder shooter, the King Super shooter from a couple years ago. he killed several people up in Boulder at the grocery store. He's still waiting for trial, and the Planned Parenthood shooter here, who moved to Colorado to smoke weed with people, and his girlfriend had a medical marijuana card. That's like 7-8 years, and he's still deemed incompetent to stand trial. So we may never know on him. So I found that if the perpetrator's dead, it typically is easier to get the toxicology result. Although there are some states, like Florida, for example, they consider the toxicology part of the medical record, despite the heinous crime the person committed. And I think Nevada is another one of those states. And some states, this is where it gets even more interesting. Like Maryland, for example, will test everything under the sun except marijuana. They'll test for antidepressant medications,
really?
and anti-inflammatories, but they won't test for marijuana. This is the state of Maryland.
And what's their excuse
for
that?
How many are we missing?
Is that just because the marijuana lobby is so strong there that they keep that all hush-hush?
I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that. It's just so fascinating to me that there's no standard of testing. Like even the like the Federal Five, which should be the Federal Six with fentanyl. You know, you're talking about cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, marijuana, and there was another one that you should test in the emergency department. Some places are getting rid of the marijuana requirement to even test. So, but I don't know what the force behind that. I don't know if it's marijuana lobby. Yeah. I don't know if it's just
Well, it's not a big mystery. I mean, gosh, any reporter can do a little background on some of these people, talk to friends, family. Hey, did they smoke pot? It's all it takes, you know. And I mean, I know that's not scientific, but
no, and that's the reason that I'm very particular about getting the report in hand,
right?
Because we have a lot of examples of people that were created mass shootings and said, well, they had a history of smoking marijuana. Well, that doesn't give it to me. Like, I just watched this little very short series on Netflix on the Boston bombers. I think the younger bomber, Boston bomber, was a marijuana dealer in college, and both of them reportedly escalated their marijuana use before they pulled that act. Hmm. But we don't know what the relationship is between that. So it's hard to, you know, there's a correlation for sure, but is there a causative effect? We don't know.
Yeah.
And that's what makes marijuana so covert and insidious, is because it doesn't work like alcohol, it doesn't work like opioids.
Right.
You know, we can't do real good. We don't have a breathalyzer for marijuana. It just doesn't work the same way. You know, it's fat soluble, it's not water soluble, it's just different. And that's what I think makes it so challenging in these particular cases. Like me and David Logg in Thousand Oaks, I killed 12 or 14 people. I have his toxicology, and there's only one thing in the system, and very high levels. So did he become psychotic because of his marijuana use? I don't know. But we do know that there was only one substance in his system, and we know that the more recent data shows increased psychosis with more frequent use and higher potency products.
Mm-hmm. And killed a Ventura County Sheriff Sergeant, I might add, during that shooting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Ken, we had talked about medical examiners and coroners, and you said you're making some success there. What about what's your thoughts about departments of health and where they're going with marijuana? And you can also segue into the FDA. Where do you think it's going with the FDA?
Ooh, well, let's start with let me go back to the coroners and medical examiners.
Okay.
It really, there's no standardization across the country on testing. So that's a big black hole. So if you have, for example, a mass shooting or a murder or what have you, depending on the jurisdiction, they may not test at all. And there is a place, you mentioned something about, do we know anything about marijuana users? And there's something called the Violence Project. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No.
Mm-mm.
So you go to their website, and it's very interesting. I looked at some of their data, and me and a couple other people looked at their data, and it's somewhat flawed, because we found several examples of mass shootings that they said had no marijuana in their system, but we have the toxicology report. And the Violence Project goes back to mass shootings from 1966, right? And we discovered that more than 53% of the mass shootings in the U.S. have occurred since 2012. Correlating with more states expanding marijuana use and access. But we found a lot of their data was missing. So I think it actually may be a little higher than that. And so I think that there's something happening with these mass shootings and cannabis, that there's some relationship there, but I can't really put my finger on it. And some coroners and medical examiners don't have to test, so I think they're missing a lot.
Is it something at a local level that we can demand or request that all of them be tested? Or I just think if it was across the board.
Yes, we actually try to work with the National Academy on Medical Examiners, and they kind of gave us a stiff arm. And these are doctors. I said, we try to submit a proposal to speak at their national conference on you know, when are you going to start considering marijuana as a potential cause of death or contributing factor? For example, there was Jelani Day in Illinois was a young man whose last known location was at a marijuana dispensary and was found a few days later floating in a river. And so I had a discussion with the coroner in that area, and I said, I understand the cause of death was drowning, but he had a fairly high level of THC in his system. I said, what do you think about that? He goes, not an issue. I said, well, what if there was alcohol in his system? Well, that would be a contributing factor. I said, what if there were opioids in the system? That would be a contributing factor. And we know that marijuana can precipitate sudden death, which you're not going to see on an autopsy, and arrhythmia, which you may not see on autopsy, as well as seizure, which you're not going to see on autopsy. So you have a young man with positive THC, and the coroner said, not a contributing factor. And I sent him all the information. He still wouldn't change his opinion. But I do ask, I said, if you haven't tested for THC or cannabinoids, can you do that? And sometimes it's hard to differentiate between, is it the dispensary cannabis that they're using or black market cannabis or the synthetic cannabis? You can do, because the coroners always say, we don't have enough money to look for cathinones, which are the metabolites of the synthetic THC. So they won't even test for it. So that's why I think there's a lot of missing data out there. And I think the Violence Project, even though they're federally funded, created their own definition of a mass shooting and don't use the federal definition of a mass shooting. So I think that their data is flawed, and they're missing a lot of information. But again, more than 53% of the mass shootings that had marijuana associated occurred in the past 10 years.
Wow. All right, Liam had a question for you.
I agree with you in the sense that marijuana might have played some kind of role in mass shootings, but I don't think it's very fair to make a blanket statement that since 2012, marijuana has it caused mass shootings?
No. I don't. I hope you didn't misunderstand me. Okay. I just said the presence of marijuana in mass shootings. 53% of the presence of marijuana in mass shootings has been since in the past 10 years.
Okay.
I didn't say there was a causal relationship.
Okay.
No.
Cool. Just clarifying, because that's dangerous.
Yeah. I can't say it's causal. I just think it's at the dance a lot.
Okay.
Yeah,
right. And the fact that we're not studying it means that we're unlikely to be able to prove that one way or the other. What was your sense of it? With you said that you talked to the, the people that actually control what the coroners do and all that. When you spoke to them on a national scale, why did they not want to look at that?
They always said it came down to funding. That they don't. They sometimes won't do it because they will. They don't have the money in their lab to test for. I'm like, it's the federal five. You should be testing it anyways, right?
Right, but if they can test for the others, I don't understand why would this cost more? Are we missing something on the complexity of this?
Exactly. And why does the state of Maryland refuse to test it? I mean, they have like 200 medications that they test that include illicits and all that other stuff, but they don't even test for the synthetic or natural cannabinoids.
Wow.
Why? I don't have an answer for that. So what are they missing? What's the state of Maryland missing?
I'll tell you what they're missing. They're missing, for example, in California, 20 of the largest farms are capable of producing more than 2.6 million pounds of marijuana, enough to supply our legal market, except law enforcement's determined that 70% of licensees strike that. 60% of cannabis grown in California is unlicensed. And so that's not even included into what the state is actually saying they can control. So we have all this unlicensed cannabis out there with these unknown adulterants in it. Is it any wonder that we have, you know, the issues that we're seeing now?
Well, because if you're not testing, A, you can't know if it's the marijuana itself.
Right.
But you absolutely can't. It's impossible to know the chemical compounds that came along with it if you're not even testing for the main substance.
Right.
Exactly.
I guess. I could say if there's some good news, Ken, and I know you know this.
What?
We
you
know
wreck the whole show.
No. Oh, okay. Well, it's good and bad. We know that the legal market has failed here in California, and I'll be interested to your read in Colorado, Ken. Because the price of marijuana has dropped so low now that you're really getting this, the illegal market, the dregs of the illegal market is growing. growing marijuana now, and that's what's flooding. As other states come on board, it's actually taking some pressure off of California, but there's such a glut of marijuana. What are you seeing in Colorado in reference to that?
And I'm terribly sorry, but it is I, the fun killer.
It's going to take us to a break?
Yeah.
Okay.
We have to have a little break. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Ken Finn.
But more rock music with Aaron.
And you're listening to We the People.
I can't get these memories out of my mind. And some kind of madness has started to evolve. I tried so hard to let you go, but some kind of madness is swallowing me whole. Yeah.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana message. Don't buy the corporate marijuana lies whose end game is to not pay any taxes. California has failed to control the grows. Dispensaries are selling out the back door as well as selling other illicit substances. Do we really need the damage to the environment, suicide, schizophrenia, hyperemesis, cardiac events in elderly users, drug driving crashes, genetic damage, pulmonary damage, neonatal low birth weight, and lost IQ for our youth? No, we don't. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Stop smoking pot. Just a thought.
And you won't be crazy in the night.
Yeah, there you go. What could she do? I'm sorry. So I was busy being the fun killer, and I forgot what we were supposed to come back with.
So Ken was going to tell us about Colorado and what's going on there. Ooh. As far as the changes compared to California. Is there a glut of marijuana there? Are dispensaries going out of business? Those kind of things.
I'm hearing the same thing. I don't know if it is as prevalent as it is in California. I know that the black market is thriving under legalization. We've got a lot of black market activity and cartels across the state, and I think that's what takes up a lot of our law enforcement time and energy is battling the black market grows, and they're like whack-a-mole. I'm sure you're dealing with the same thing. It's like as soon as you put one out here, there's another one popping up there, and it could be the same people. You know, and the state isn't really aggressive. The DAs aren't willing to prosecute a lot of these things. They do come back like cockroaches, and they end up in the same house. And we have examples of illegal grow houses in Colorado, for example, that owned several houses in this one little area, and the entity that owned those homes had ties to Miami that had a Cuban bank affiliation. So you can backtrack it. And actually the person that owned that particular LLC was the name of a dead person that lived in the neighborhood years before. So it's like, but the state lets it go. We have examples of a large warehouse in southern Colorado that the registered agent was a 14-year-old girl. That was rubber stamped by the state. I mean, it's just an absolute disaster.
Yeah. Well, you have the same problem here. A lot of these illegal grows, you can't find the owner. I mean, they change the owner's name so often. I mean, you spend your entire time chasing a ghost, and in the meantime, they just continue to grow.
No pun intended.
The only hope that we have for our county is a good sheriff who's going after marijuana and destruction orders from the judges. Where a lot of counties in California are not able to get that, we do get that. So our marijuana team can go after with a skid steer and bulldoze, $100,000 worth of infrastructure. It takes them more than 72 hours to come back.
Well, it also takes funding that they have to get approved, and that seems to be a big stumbling block
So, Ken, some statistics from the FAA. You know, we have, of course, drug driving, and now we have all of these passengers on airplanes flying under the influence. And that statistic this year put out by the FAA is there's been a 2,500% increase just this year, and an increase every year since it's been tracked from 2017. And we're talking about airline flight crews having to deal with people coming out of the lavatories or actually vaping in their seats, and they have to act as police on aircraft. I'm wondering if under the classic signs of addiction where someone can't stop using for even an hour or two-hour flight, what do you think? I mean, under the classic word addiction, are they addicted if they can't stop and they have to use while they're getting on an airplane for whatever reason?
By definition, that's addiction. But we've been terribly disappointed with the FAA. They really are reluctant to respond to our request for drug testing. And I don't know the world of, you know, airline travel. You know, if you're up in the air, who has jurisdiction? If they leave California and they're going to Florida, you know, and in the middle of the flight, somebody has an episode. We don't know what, you know, when they land, obviously that's where the law enforcement comes involved. But they don't test really at all, these people. They say, well, then they're just impaired and they're unruly. But there's no mandate to test for anything, really, including cannabis and some of these unruly passengers that we're aware of. And we've done several requests. One of the people we work with, who hopefully is listening still, we found an example of a mechanic, an airline mechanic, who was threatened because he was going to be turned in to a supervisor for his chronic, ongoing, consistent marijuana use as he's tinkering on jet airliners. Oh, that's wonderful. A frightening data point. We have that information. I mean, it's not like we're making it up.
As in the medical world, we're always worried about what a doctor can be under the influence of. Doctors are not allowed to be under the influence of marijuana, are they? Or can they use it as well?
You bring up a really scary point.
Yeah.
It's a very scary point. I can tell you that, you know, some of the hospitals don't do employee testing on their physicians. They don't test for cannabis. They got rid of it. We do know that this is obviously hearsay, but I was giving an interview for Channel 9 in Denver by a physician, and she's like, oh, yeah, a couple of my friends who are surgeons tell me that they take a hit off a vape pen before they go in the ER because it calms their nerves. I'm like, well, I go, don't. She goes, do you wonder who they are? I go, no, if I know who they are, I have the duty to report. You should have a duty to report. You know, they could be impaired. I mean, would you, one, have your gallbladder taken out knowing that your surgeon and anesthesiologist may have been, you know, taking a hit off a dab last night?
Only if I wanted a sponge left inside.
Can persist down the road, even though you feel fine, you know, 24 hours later. They've done, you know, simulated pilot studies and driving studies that people can still be impaired.
We're seeing that. We're seeing that attack. I call it an attack from the industry here in California, where you're seeing unions, i.e. fire department unions or state fire unions, where employees are saying that when they're off duty, they should be able to use marijuana, and they're being backed up. And now they tried it in law enforcement, but since it's federally illegal, law enforcement said, nope, you can't do it. But it's constantly, that law is constantly being attacked by the unions.
You know, when you get into the anesthesia realm, I'm thankful because I've been trying to, you know, like again, I said earlier, I felt like an Army One forever, but there's an organization called ASRA, which is the Anesthesia Society of Regional, there's a American Society of Regional Anesthesia, and they came out with a consensus statement stating that you should be screening your patients that are having surgical procedures. And I'm so glad they did it. I published a paper like 2 years before saying kind of the same thing, but I was ignored because I'm just me, a little solo practitioner in Colorado. But you had a group of, you know, probably 8 or 10 well-known physicians saying you have to screen your patients because there are problems for patients undergoing anesthesia. There's drug interactions. They have, they're harder to put to sleep.
Right.
They're harder to keep asleep. They have trouble with their medication management post-op. So, and a lot of the data is very is there about, you know, they have poor sleep, they have higher, you know, perhaps higher costs, hospitalization costs, difficult to maintain, manage their pain, they consume more opioids post-op, because there's a very intricate link between the opioid and cannabinoid system, which we probably don't have enough time to go into, and we're happy to explain it down the road, but they're very, very tightly connected. And that's why I think that, you know, there is something there about the analgesic properties, but, you know, give me a cannabinoid that's proven to be effective and doesn't have fungus in it.
It doesn't need a blowtorch.
And proven to be effective, and I'm fine with that. But those products don't exist.
Yeah, and really, when you go into an operation and something goes wrong with the anesthesia, who are they going to go after? And here, this poor guy had no idea. The guy was half high on pot when he administered.
Did they ask you that?
Anesthesia. I
don't know. I don't remember.
I was going to ask Ken. Ken, as far as pre-op instructions, you know, is cannabis use now being on a regular basis being asked of patients? And if so, if they admit it, because many probably would deny, if they admit it, is that a prerequisite for denying an operation?
No, I think it's not being ubiquitously screened. I think people are moving in that direction. One of my colleagues here in town, I heard, didn't get it straight from him, but I heard he canceled somebody's surgery unless they stopped smoking for 2 weeks. They wanted it completely out of their system.
Good for him.
You know, we know it can persist. So
if you're taking, all right, so let's go back to the driving, right? So you go back to the driving and somebody's in some sort of an accident, well, you don't have time to get anything out of your system. You're rushed to the hospital and there's stuff being done. So potentially, I'm assuming they would not test for that before they would treat you.
No, when in an emergent situation, they just treat you.
Yeah. So all this interaction business then throws off a second wave of terror.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like the anesthesia, it's like, why can't I keep this person asleep? What's going on? And there's no history.
Right.
They may be unconscious from their car crash.
Sure.
And they're just trying to.
So if they're long-time pot users,
they can get their surgery done.
The anesthesiologist.
Right. It counteracts.
Yeah, they can't keep them asleep. That is so weird.
People use it to help sleep.
Okay, that's where I was.
Right.
Yeah, the wheels in my mind were turning. I'm like, wait a minute, I don't get it.
I could see them.
I'm like, why are you taking it to sleep if it makes you stay awake?
You know, that's so interesting because there's this debate about whether or not it's a sleep aid. Again, we haven't studied it enough. And when I read a lot of these publications, the thing that bothers me the most is like, well, cannabis might be effective treatment for pain. And then you go look for the devil in the details, and they don't tell you anything about the products these people are using.
Right.
Are they using a 10% product? Are they using a 90% product? And what's going on there? And that's why I think a lot of these studies are flawed, because there's no good consistency and documentation of what these people take. And they just say, well, cannabis helps for pain.
And what about your ability to, you know, build a tolerance to it?
Exactly.
That's kind of an unknown.
Yeah. So my question here, too, is here in California, basically we decriminalized marijuana back in 1986. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah. There's nobody in jail for marijuana.
Yeah, so quote-unquote nobody in jail. So since 1986, why have we been so slow to study this? I mean, we only recently have we, like people like you, have really dwelled into this product, and I just don't understand that. We've had years and years and years.
Yeah, because the reason they had to legalize it was so that they could regulate it and make it safe, blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's not completely true. I mean, if you actually go to clinicaltrials.gov, there have been over 30,000 studies on marijuana, despite its Schedule I classification.
Right.
And the government has spent billions of dollars on studying marijuana already. You know, I'm always supportive of ongoing research, and I think in this day and age, with more acceptance and more availability, I think there's more data coming out.
Right.
So I completely support it, but the study of cannabis has been going on since the way back in the day.
So, spoiler alert that for us. What's it showing?
What's that?
What is it showing? What's that revealing, the study?
Oh, it's becoming a public health and safety disaster.
Right.
Really.
Yeah,
especially when you
be.
Throw the environment, with you guys in California, when you throw the environmental impacts in there, it's just going to be terrible.
And the marijuana people have they every time you turn around, they're engineering and coming up with some new product or some new THC element, or you know how
so much of it is chemical.
There's how do you study something that is just like this snowball?
You're chasing your tail,
right?
Because it's always evolving. Like these DAZ waxes and shatters didn't exist 15 years ago.
No,
they've only been recent, so we're really in uncharted waters. We don't know what's going to happen to the people that are using them in 10 years or 20 years from now. We already know the emerging data on women using during pregnancy. It's absolutely frightening what is happening to the offspring.
Right.
With their behavior, even though they're not using it, middle childhood at 10 years of age, they have psychotic-like experiences. They have behavior problems, social problems at school. And, you know, NIDA just came out, followed up with that study, saying those problems persist into adolescence. So we're creating a new generation of we don't know what's going to happen, you know, drug-seeking behavior and violence and all this stuff as a result of in utero exposures. And not all women use during pregnancy, obviously, but the ones that are using regularly, the offspring are having problems.
Right.
That's been documented in both animal and human studies.
I'm curious to know, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I am curious to know what you're seeing with the effects on children, because I know that they had recently in major media published that they were getting overdoses in like San Diego and that sort of thing. And I know here in Reading, we had some kids who ate candy that was, obviously full of THC. It wasn't real candy. And I had people who were contacting, our local congressional office saying, well, we need to label it. And it's like, I'm sorry, when was the last time a child read a candy wrapper? Mostly never. Grown-ups don't even read candy wrappers.
Well,
and they look just like gummy bears, et cetera, et cetera. I'd like to know if you've seen any studies or anything on that crossover, because I think that's actually just incredibly dangerous for our kids going forward.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So we're here with Dr. Ken Finn. Well, we're not really here with him. He's really on the phone. He lives in Colorado. But good for him for hanging out with us on Sunday afternoon. And you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Shared sleeping in an alley didn't matter to me. I got lost walking in the valley. Well, it could have been 1993 when it goes badly after burning so bright. Trying to make sense of a hopeless situation. Feels like dying in the middle of the night. When it goes badly, you're alone in the darkness. Nothing's ever will ever make it right.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. In a recent court case, Freed versus Garland, it was determined both medical and recreational marijuana users have no right to firearms because marijuana use was associated with elevated risky decision-making. It is beyond dispute that marijuana users experience altered mental states that affect their judgment, creating irrational and unpredictable behavior. There is a clear relationship between the bevy of recent active shooters and marijuana use. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Traitor and the monkey man were hot up for cash. They stayed up all night selling cocaine and hash to an undercover cop who had a sister named Jan. For reasons unexplained, she loved the monkey man. A bus scout before she went to Vietnam and found out the hard way nobody gives a damn. They knew that they'd find freedom just across the Jersey line, so they hopped into a stolen car, took Highway 99,
and the walls came down. All the way to hell. Never saw
song for you. So, kids being affected by this new, you know, because back in the day, I mean, you knew marijuana when you saw it. I remember in school. Right. Remember they'd bring out this is what marijuana looks like. This is what it smells like.
Well, reefer madness.
Well, there's
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
But I remember my dad.
The little clips.
Yeah.
You know.
But they had like little boards with all this stuff stuck to it, and they came and showed you all that stuff.
Yeah.
But now, I don't know. Now it looks like gummy bears, or whatever.
Or an inhaler. I love that one.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that one. Inhaler, yeah.
Well, they banned candy cigarettes because it was a bad influence on kids. But it's okay to sell.
Let's get back to the candy cigarettes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. So, what are you seeing in that? Is there any discussion in the wider venue about that, Dr. Finn?
Oh yeah, the American Academy of Pediatrics had a paper that came out in January of this year showing that pediatric poisonings went up 1,300% in 4 years, 1,375% just between 17 and 21, so 4 years. 70% of those that had a known outcome had central nervous system depression. So again, young children don't metabolize it like we do, and they can have problems. Nearly 23% of those kids ended up in the hospital. And again, 4% end up on a ventilator.
How do you treat those kids medically, Doc?
Symptomatically. You just have to treat it. There's no antidote. There's no Narcan for marijuana poisoning.
Supportive care, ABCs?
Yep. Yes, supportive care. Let them write it out. The same with the elderly. I mean, my emergency medicine colleagues have had, you know, the 80-year-old grandma that came in from the nursing home because their grandkid thought it would be great for them to have a little marijuana cupcake for their birthday. And they end up catatonic, and, you know, they end up not responsive, and then they end up in the ER, and all they can do is just wait it out. They're clogging up space. But then, you know, they can run into drug interactions or have heart issues.
Oh, yeah.
They have to monitor these patients because they can have trouble. But the pediatric poisonings is really frightening data. And the elderly that I mentioned earlier, that was an 1,800% increase in California, the elderly going to the ER.
Jesus.
Ken, if I recall, you also did put out a videotape at one point of an actual patient, without violating patient confidentiality, who was exhibiting hyperemesis. Was that you that put that out?
That was not me. That was I think that was either Dr. Lev or Dr. Randall, both of which are emergency medicine physicians. And the one I saw was the audio, which is, you know, it's almost horrific. There's a term they call it scromiting, which is screaming and vomiting. And, you know, people have died from hyperemesis because of electrolyte imbalances and stuff. So don't let anybody say that marijuana has never killed anybody. It can in the right situation. But when you have hyperemesis, you can even go to the Facebook page, Recovery from Hyperemesis Syndrome, Cannabinoid Hyperemesis Syndrome. They have like 20,000 followers. And just read some of the stories of some of these people that are affected. It just doesn't go away sometimes. I mean, they're sick for months and months sometimes. And it's just unbelievable that people say, well, I just feel a little nauseous. And again, that's kind of the circular thing with marijuana is that it's supposed to treat nausea, so people are using marijuana for the nausea, but the nausea persists, so they continue to use. And it's this vicious cycle. And they end up down this road with cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, and they're in the ER all the time. And the only treatment is stop using.
What about the treatment of hot showers? And then I also hear that using some antipsychotic medications or something like that is effective?
The hot showers is something that can mitigate some of the symptoms. Some patients have reported using that capsaicin cream, like the hot pepper cream, because it feels warm. But there's no real good treatment for the hyperemesis because it doesn't respond to the traditional antiemetics like Zofran or Phenergan. They just don't. And so the antipsychotics there's some preliminary data like Haldol, which is an antipsychotic medication, can mitigate some of the symptoms associated with hyperemesis. But I don't know as much about that research as some of my colleagues might, but that's what I've heard. But, you know, the ones that are ending up in the emergency department can be pretty sick sometimes, especially the little kids.
What about getting off marijuana and detoxing? That was the next subject we wanted to talk to you about, especially as a pain management specialist.
You know, it's so interesting you bring that up because I don't see a lot of marijuana addiction in my practice, but I know a lot of psychiatrists in the state. For example, I asked one of my colleagues in Denver who's affiliated with the university up there, I asked him about adolescents. I said, how many kids, what percent of your patient population are there for cannabis use disorder? Take a guess what his response was to me.
100%.
Very close, 97%.
Wow.
97%.
Wow.
He treats adolescents with a variety. You know, kids use all sorts of stuff. But, you know, over time, he's seen the numbers increase to the point where the vast majority are there for cannabis use disorder. And those kids aren't in school to take surveys, like the Healthy Kids Colorado survey.
Oh, right, sure, right. That makes sense.
What's that?
Yeah, that makes sense. They're not there to take the surveys, so you don't know.
They're not there to take the surveys, right. but a lot of the states, you know, they promote right. their surveys saying, hey, our kids are doing fine.
Yep.
And I'm like, well, the ones that aren't doing fine can't take your stupid survey.
Okay, so when you talk about cannabis use disorder, so for people who are thinking, oh, what does that even mean? What does that even mean?
Cannabis use disorder is basically an addiction where you have a hard time stopping, and when you do stop, it has a very well-documented withdrawal syndrome. You have drug craving, you have sweating, you feel nauseous, you feel crummy. That's a cannabis use disorder. And historically, the numbers were, it's like 18% in the adolescent develop a cannabis use disorder and 9% in the adult. So people are like, well, it's not as addictive as some of these other things that we're dealing with, like nicotine and opioids. But the data's changed, especially as the products have morphed into more high potency. The cannabis use disorder rates are now 30%, so they're up there with things like nicotine. Some of these strong products are very, very addictive, and when you have a cannabis use disorder, you have a hard time managing your use. It's not like, well, I'm just going to, you know, go out and take a hit off a bong on Saturday with my friends. It's like you're using more. You can't stop. It starts to control your life, and if you do stop, you have withdrawal, and that's by definition a use disorder.
Right.
And we know in society, we saw that Marijuana Biz Daily just put out the statistic that more marijuana is consumed by Americans now than beer or chocolate.
And, what?
It's approaching cigarettes. So the use in our country is just skyrocketing. And we don't know. That's the legal use. We have no idea what the illegal use is, where it's coming from illegal.
Oh, that's true. Well, it's interesting, too, that something that supposedly is not addictive, which is what you hear all the time.
It's nature's plan.
Yeah. It's not addicting. But it's kind of funny you have withdrawals from it.
Yeah, this is a big marijuana playbook. You remember the day? I don't know if you've ever caught the video of the big tobacco trials.
Yep.
And if they went down the line with all these executives saying nicotine's not addicting. And they went boom, 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 boom.
And the doctors were smoking it.
Yeah. It doesn't cause cancer.
Doesn't cause cancer. You know, it's an interesting topic, though. I mean, the cancer thing is not proven yet, especially lung cancer,
right.
which I'm somewhat surprised when people are smoking or vaping and doing this damage to their lungs. I just think we're not there yet. I think it didn't take, you know, we didn't know about lung cancer until tobacco was mass commercialized.
Right.
Because people back in the 1600s that were, you know, farming tobacco in the Carolinas, some of them probably got cancer. Maybe they didn't live long enough back then to develop cancer. We don't know, but we know that cancer didn't become a problem until mass commercialization. And I think we're just in the early stages of that with marijuana, with the mass commercialization. So we won't know probably for 20, 30 years.
And what's so sad is this is what we are leaving our children.
Yeah, exactly.
And we had Dr. Reese, and we interviewed him on this show. Aaron and Bill interviewed
him several times
and spoke about actual, was it changes to DNA, Aaron?
He was talking chromosomal about damage.
Chromosomal damage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
It's funny because I think one of his papers published about the autism rates in marijuana states compared to non-marijuana states are like 20% higher. And there's Susan Murphy from Duke University did some animal studies that, because they always point the finger at the woman, and, you know, God bless the women that have to, you know, bear children. You know, it's very painful. But the men that use marijuana, they alter the autism gene. I didn't even know there was an autism gene until I talked to Dr. Murphy at Duke University. But in the animal studies, they exposed the parent, the father rat to marijuana, and the offspring, even though the mom rat didn't get the exposed, the offspring had changes in their autism DNA.
Whoa.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Did not know that. Meanwhile, everybody's worried about, you know, all sorts of things causing autism, and one of the things is right in front of our face.
Yeah, but add it to the list. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the mom. That's the other thing. It's not just the mom. It's the dad's use.
Yeah.
So a lot of, so we don't know. And again, I'm going to use the term covert and insidious because I think it's there. You know, I think it's at the dance. A lot of these and all these things that we've talked about, it's there at the dance, but it's not being implicated.
In the last couple of minutes here, there are still a lot of people you know utilizing like the CBD products or the non-THC products. And they're being told that that has no effects. Dr. Reese had a completely different take on that. What are you seeing on the physician side for that?
On using CBD compared to?
Yeah, not even compared to, but
medication.
No blowback alternative.
CBD suppository for whatever.
CBD is not going to get you stoned like THC is, but it's certainly not benign. I already talked about the 575
right.
drug interactions it has. There's only one FDA-purified CBD on the planet. That's Epidiolex, and the people from Alabama that got it through the FDA actually wrote my chapter on seizure. It's very well done. But if you go to the Epidiolex website and you look at warnings and precautions, you're going to see, number one, liver damage, number two, suicidal behavior and ideation, and number three, sedation and somnolence. So I think it was the FDA or CDC had a warning on using CBD in driving because it can make you tired. I actually had a patient who was in her early 60s that tried CBD, and she became suicidal. So it's not benign. It has its own baggage for sure, even though it's touted as being the safe alternative to THC. And there was a study out of Massachusetts that patients coming in an emergency department that were using a CBD-dominant product, nearly 30% of the time had no CBD in it. Again, my issue and my platform on product integrity, and the ones that had, and actually those products had a lot of THC in it, and the ones that were THC dominant, a lot of them didn't even, they had much higher levels of THC than was on the label.
Right.
I mean, so it's just kind of a disaster because it's mislabeling, it's
no
it's
control.
Patient safety.
As a consumer, you're at the mercy of the labeling unless you're secretly a scientist and you can run home and test everything before you take it.
Well, it's interesting. They put a warning label on CBD, but we don't get a warning label on
THC.
Yeah, kind of funny.
It's ironic.
We really appreciate all the work that you're doing in getting the word out and the Isaac website. It's IASIC1.org for people that are looking for information. And if you'd like to get a wider range of information, WeThePeopleRadio.us, there's a tab up top marked POT, and we've got video, audio, lots of different interviews. They are all commercial-free, as this one will be later this afternoon. So we're not copyrighted. We do this program as a service to the public, so we hope that you will share it and use it to get the information from people like Dr. Finn out there. It's really worth it. Thank you very much for being on with us.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for the opportunity. You guys enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks too. A bunch.
Thanks, Ken.
And we're looking forward to hearing from people if they want to. You can go to the website and email us if you'd like. It's WeThePeopleRadio.us.
For the wicked, money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back, but you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.